Hi, I'm Kyla.
And this is Jay.
And you're listening to Strange Fruit by WFPL.
So, Doc, these are interesting times we're living in. Of course, with 45 in the White House, it seems that every day there's something new being said or done that is just, frankly, super, super racist, right? The most recent example, of course, is our beloved Roseanne.
Yes.
By beloved, I mean not beloved, Roseanne. And her inflammatory comments about Valerie Jarrett comparing her to an ape. You know, there was when Obama was in the White House, people were saying that Ronald Reagan, that was, if you remember, there was a picture of Ronald Reagan back in the day, like bottle feeding like a baby, like chimpanzee.
Mm-hmm.
And so someone had posted like, here's Ronald Reagan babysitting Barack Obama. So there's always like racist stuff being done. And most of the time it happens, right, via memes or pictures. And people claim, like, I had no idea that saying this kind of thing or reposting this meme was something racist, right?
Mm-hmm.
And probably the most legendary thing besides the ape and the monkey situation is like comparing or basically situating Black people with watermelon and chicken,
yes,
as a racist kind of trope, right?
Yeah, it's a long enduring
stereotype. And then they go, oh, I had no idea that the watermelon was racist. Yeah, you did. That's why you did it.
Okay.
And so, you know, I was curious, like where did that come from? Like, what, you know, we wondered, like, where did this originate? And so there was a really cool think piece that was written actually back in 2014, but it's actually very relevant. It popped up on my news feed, and so I had to hunt down the author, and he wrote a piece called How Watermelons Became a Racist Trope. So, listeners, please welcome to the show Bill Black. Hi, Bill. How are you?
Doing good. How about you?
Phenomenal. So, Bill, you're a PhD candidate at Rice University in what subject?
History.
In history. Okay, good. So, well, there we go, right on time. So, Bill, speaking of history, so apparently, watermelons were not always associated with, number one, with Black people, and number two, they were not always a racist trope. Give us, our listeners, a quick background on how watermelons came to be associated with Black people to begin with, and then what the history was like before that, in terms of watermelons.
Yeah. Well, I think, first, there's a few traits to watermelons that I think informed this stereotype that emerged later, and they predate the racist stereotype, certain connotations associated with the fruit. For one thing, it's associated with laziness, because a watermelon's kind of a hard fruit to eat while you're working. You kind of have to sit down and eat it. It's not like an apple or something.
Yeah, it gets a little messy.
That's another thing. It's messy. It just gets everywhere. You got rinds everywhere. And also, it's something that's kind of hard to eat by yourself. So it's typically going to be a group of people not working, eating, you know, a rather sweet fruit. So it kind of got associated with uncleanliness and childishness. And in the 18th, early 19th century, it was actually usually associated with the Middle East and also like Southern Europe, which is where kind of watermelons came to America from those regions. And so people would go on grand tours of the Near East, and they would see people eating watermelon, and sort of the great granddaddy of the stereotype existed then, but associated with people in the Middle East. What really surprised me as I was doing research on this was how sudden the stereotype emerged. It did not exist before emancipation. In other words, it wasn't associated with Black people in America before emancipation, even though it's not like Black people just suddenly started eating watermelon in 1863 or 1865. What beforehand white people had sort of seen as a sign of their benevolence. Oh, you know, we let our slaves have a little watermelon of their patch of their own, and, you know, maybe we let them sell them, you know, go into the town square and sell it on the weekend or something like that. When Black people were free and doing that, then it was a threat. And so pretty much with emancipation, that stigma that had existed beforehand associated with the Middle East gets pinned on Black people. And it's really because it's an assertion of their freedom and autonomy. It's something that they can grow on their own, that they can operate outside the plantation economy and get some quick cash, and also to celebrate.
Yeah, so it really represented, and you argue this in your think piece as well as your long form essay about the history of how watermelon became racist. It's not just this idea that watermelon for African Americans represented their citizenry, it represented a certain type of freedom. And you argue in your long form piece on this very topic about how it's not just the court, the ballot, the noose, etc., that white Southerners use, but it was also this idea of cultural tropes. Can you talk about the significance of racist cultural tropes and how they become very, very important to denying certain ideas of citizenry when it comes to that of African Americans?
Yeah, I mean, you know, this gets to the question of, well, you know, how seriously should we take these tropes? I think often when we don't know the history of it, we can just say, oh, well, you know, what's so bad about watermelon? It seems relatively harmless. And I think we have to understand derogatory stereotypes like those associated with watermelon or sort of fried chicken or other similar ones as part of a spectrum of tools that white people used after emancipation to basically say that African Americans were not fit for citizenship. And so for an example, there was a story in a Georgian newspaper in the 1870s describing a black man who had been arrested for attempting to poison someone with a watermelon that he'd apparently plugged with strychnine or something. And it describes him as this strapping 14th Amendment. They call him a 14th Amendment as if that's sort of a euphemism for black people, that they saw a strapping 14th Amendment headed towards the courthouse with this large watermelon over his shoulder. And it was meant to make him look ridiculous, as if even worse than him, you know, attempting to you know, kill someone was the fact that he would be in public with this large childish fruit. You know, this is a time when African Americans are, you know, wanting freedom not just at the ballot, but also to have their own property, to be able to make their own, generate their own wealth. And if you derogate the growing and selling of watermelons as something that's sort of silly and childish, then you are derogating the attempts of those people to, you know, generate their own wealth and to escape out of, you know, sharecropping and other similar economies. Yeah.
It's interesting. So the primary, I guess, the underlying kind of message of the watermelon, I guess, is just to say that black people were not ready for the end of enslavement. We weren't ready for freedom, right? That we were somehow too childlike. In the same way that you mentioned, so I think about it in my own. I don't eat watermelon anymore, but in my own family cookouts, you have watermelon, right? You do share it with everybody. It's communal, mm-hmm. right? You cut it into maybe 12 slices. Everybody sits down, some newspaper maybe, you spit your seeds on the ground. So I guess from, you know, without a particular context about how watermelon is eaten, it would look really dirty and messy and lazy and I think you even say that with D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation is when that really kind of helped perpetuate, you know, that narrative of watermelon feast, of black people just sitting around loving watermelon.
When does print media and, you know, I mean, obviously film and print media pick up on this stereotype that white Southerners are trying to push forward?
Because it becomes like potholders, paperweights, salt shakers.
I mean, it clearly represented a subversive power, right? Yeah. It represented economic independence. It represented that black people were not enslaved. They were not in bondage. They were their own human
beings. And in fact, they were happy enough to be eating some
fruit.
Right, yeah.
And relaxing, right? So, like, when does print media and, you know, film pick up on the stereotype that
in
white Southerners.
In a popular way,
You know, it happens pretty quickly. I mean, most of what I was looking at was newspapers, at least in the 1860s, 70s. And you see, you know, there's an example of a newspaper I want to say 1866. It shows a scene of freed people selling watermelons in Charleston. And it portrays them respectfully as equals with the white people who are buying the watermelons from them. And then I want to say 1873, 1874, that same paper Frank Leslie's Illustrated newspaper has a scene of African-Americans eating watermelon, I want to say, in Savannah, Georgia. And it depicts them as childish, barefoot, hanging around on, you know, on cotton bales, you know, sort of, you can imagine slurping, juice dripping. So it was a pretty sudden, you know, within the span of a decade, not even that much. And it really tracks the something that was a larger story, which is that pretty quickly after the Civil War, white Northerners kind of threw Southern black people under the bus and abandoned the project of Reconstruction and kind of came to agree with white Southerners that, like, you know what, y'all are right. You know, these people weren't really ready for their freedom. And so, you know, it's not too long after that that a pretty wide consensus in the North supports withdrawing troops, the last troops out of the South, and pretty much ceding the quote unquote, you know, Negro question to the basically the old, well, what had been the slaveholding elite. So it happens pretty quickly and does not stay in the South that long. And yeah, it and by, you know, the late 19th century, it's all over sheet music and postcards. And I think probably by that point, probably by 1890, people probably didn't even know that the stereotype was relatively young. They probably thought that, oh, it's just sort of this thing that had been around forever.
Yeah. Before we let you go, Beal, there were some funny parts about the watermelon. I guess the story of watermelon in particular. You mentioned in one of your pieces an enslaved person by the name of Israel Campbell, and so Israel would go to the cotton field dock and he'd pick his cotton. And, you know, there was oftentimes a quota. You had to have so many pounds, so many tens of pounds of cotton
a day. Yeah, people who've seen 12 Years a Slave have seen something like that.
Yeah. And so Israel,
he had to take a certain amount of cotton a day.
He was cunning. So he would take his watermelon because, again, the enslaved Africans were able to have watermelon kind of at their own leisure. Mm-hmm. So he was cunning, right? Israel was like, yo, I'm a little short of my quota today. So he would actually take a watermelon and put it at the bottom of his cotton bale. And so when it was weighed at the end of the day, you know, the enslaver was like, great
heavier.
Job, Israel. You really got your quota today, right? And then he's like, yeah, then, massa. Then he would take his watermelon out and he'd eat it and he'd go about his business, right? So I love that even in the midst of, you know, we try to make, we're not making light of enslavement, but even still. And so Israel was like, yo, he put the other enslaved Africans onto this too. Like, yo, you just got whipped for not meeting your quota. Let me put you on this watermelon tree.
Yeah.
You know,
and
so I think that
there's multiple ways to resist and that enslaved people use their wits around a lot of their bondage.
Yeah. Well, before we go, I want to say what I appreciate, William, about Beal, rather, about the end of your think piece, that you make the case that it doesn't really matter what one's intent is, right? So people may say, oh, I had no idea that me posting Ronald Reagan feeding a baby monkey was racist. I had no idea, mm-hmm. Roseanne says, that calling Valerie Jarrett an ape was, it doesn't matter what you intended, right? The reality is these racialized tropes have a history. They're usually tied to some kind of traumatic period in time or some kind of traumatic event. So regardless or irregardless of how one intends it, the reality is all these tropes, right, all these kind of memes, all these things really do have a story behind them. And they do have the ability to take on a life of their own. And that's what leads someone like an officer in Ohio to look at Tamir Rice, who's but a boy, and say he looked like a grown man. That's what allows a Darren Wilson to look at Michael Brown and say he looked like a demon, right? Because they have these tropes that breed fear, right? The birth of a nation, this notion of black men coming to take your white women. These things, right? We retweet them, we share them, we like them. And they become part of our psyche, Doc. Would you agree?
Yeah, is that that's what I really loved about both your pieces too, Bill, is that they really shed light on how powerful cultural production and the reproduction of these racist tropes and stereotypes continue to reiterate in the minds of many. The ineptness, the unintelligentness, the brutishness, the violent nature, I mean, right, all these things. So in as much as we've made advancements as a community, you know, African-Americans in terms of voting, in terms of access, I mean, even the last president, right, was an African-American. And nonetheless, anytime those advancements happen, these kind of cultural reproductions that are used over and over again every generation are trying to reassert that, you know, that those stereotypes, right? So as much as we oh, well, this is a black physician over here. You got a black pilot over here. You got a black president over here. But at the end of the day, y'all are monkeys. Y'all Absolutely. Are nothing but childlike. Y'all are not fit to be citizens. And so the recalling of these cultural images is just as important as passing legislation, laws, creating education around these things. So we really appreciate you drawing on the history of these cultural symbols and telling us where they originate, why they originated, and how detrimental they've been.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, thank you.
Yes, listeners, this has been William R. Black. Beal is a doctoral candidate in history at Rice University. By the way, as I mentioned, y'all, the think piece was from 2014, but it's still a really good read. It's on theatlantic.com. It's called How Watermelon Became a Racist Trope. Beal, thank you so much for being with us, and please take care, okay?
Thank you. You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Beal.
Bye-bye.
So, Doc, a few years ago, you and I were at the Carnegie. I want to make sure I say it right. The Carnegie Center. It's over in Southern Indiana. It is a really, really wonderful local institution. I mean, we obviously have the Speed Art Museum over here. Mm-hmm. And because we're Louisvillians and because you go to U of L or teach U of L, we're obligated, loyal to the Speed, right? But the Carnegie, I tell you what, is doing, Doc, some really, really groundbreaking stuff. You and I hosted a Black Arts and Black Artists Matter panel with some phenomenal black artists. It was a wonderful event. And I saw I've really been keeping an eye on the Carnegie website, carnegiecenter.org. Mm-hmm. And I noticed that they have a really, really cool exhibit that's currently running. I think it's going to be part of that part of that permanent exhibit that documents a number of things. And the woman in particular, her name is Lucy Higgs Nichols. And the story kind of all begins with this old kind of sepia colored photograph of like a dozen like white men. And there might be a man of color, but it looks like a dozen white men. One of them is just dark. But, you know, like a dozen, two dozen white men. Yeah. And then like right in the middle of the group, there is a black woman. And we're like, okay, who was that black woman? So we had to get to the bottom of this person, Lucy Higgs Nichols. And so, listeners, please welcome to the show to discuss this real life hot topic, Al Gorman. Al Gorman is the coordinator of public programs and engagement at the Carnegie Center for Art History. Al, welcome to the show. How are you?
Appreciate it. Thank you very much. I'm glad to talk about Lucy, one of my favorite stories.
Please, so just give us, I know the name. Mm-hmm. We know there's a photograph. Mm-hmm. And I'm fascinated. Tell us, who was Lucy Higgs Nichols, and why is she in your museum?
A fascinating American story, and a story we nearly lost to history. There was one family in town in New Albany that remembered the Higgs, Lucy Higgs Nichols. When we have school groups come in, one of the things I like to do is take them to this picture that you were just describing, because it is the only picture we have of Lucy Higgs Nichols. So when these kids come in and say, how many pictures of grandma and grandpa have of you? Millions. So what if you're only known by single image? Yeah. And this is that image.
Because she was born back in 1838.
That's right.
She died in 1915. So,
yes.
This is the only picture we got, because there really weren't, there wasn't Instagram and stuff like that back in the 1800s, though.
Yeah, in fact, there wasn't freedom, right?
That either. So she was a nurse. Mm-hmm. She was an escaped enslaved person.
That's right.
But tell us, what makes her story so fascinating?
There are several parts of her story.
Okay.
The first part, just the fact that she was able to successfully escape as the wars blowing up in 1862. She and her husband and their little girl Mona, they were living near a town, Bolivar, Tennessee.
Okay.
Which is today kind of outside present day Memphis, just east of Memphis.
Okay.
But she runs into men from the Indiana 23rd, a Union group, an all volunteer Union regiment based out of New Albany. And at this point, the escaped slaves are considered contraband of war.
Okay.
And so what normally had happened was even Union soldiers would return escapees to their owners. And in fact, her owners came after her. Yes, the Indiana 23rd sent her back because it would hurt the war effort on the South if they had returned the slaves. So what they in fact did was offered her and her family protection. And so for the rest of the war, Lucy essentially functioned as their nurse. And she was in 28 battles and had gone as far west as Vicksburg, Mississippi. And she's all the way – she makes the march to the sea, is in the siege of Atlanta and Savannah.
Oh, wow.
And when the war is over, she's marching down the Grand Boulevards in Washington, D.C. with these men as a proud veteran of this effort.
So does she actually live over in New Albany, Indiana? What is her connection to? So she actually walked these same very grounds that we're on today, huh?
That's right. I mean, this is one of the things that's so interesting about this story. It's like, okay, after this grand parade, the war is over, Lucy Higgs Nichols, where's she going to live?
Yeah.
And so the men from the Indiana 23rd, the bond that was born between them through battle, eventually they make the invitation for her to come live in New Albany, and that's what she does. And it's not necessarily because New Albany was the most
progressive
but she
became part of their family essentially,
where did she learn her nursing skills? Was it just something that she picked up? Was her mother a nurse or folks in her family?
She has no medical training whatsoever.
But
she's a highly intelligent, highly resourceful person.
As were most enslaved Africans back then, right? Yeah. Without formalized training. They were taking people's kids, and they were, they had it. They might not have had the formal education, right?
Yeah.
Or the social standing in life, but they certainly had a high
skill
set.
Well, that's why I was asking, maybe an elder in her family.
Yeah, pass
she
it
had
on.
Seen, you know, I mean, most of the practices that enslaved folks, you know, participated in were because they had seen someone in their family, someone close to them, do those same things, whether that's healing or nursing or something like that. And so I was thinking maybe the exhibit showed like how Lucy knew or became this kind of nurse, if you will.
Actually, we're in some ways a little bit fortunate with Lucy that we actually know some information about her.
But
some of the questions you were just asking, that's far more detailed.
But not so much her like childhood or upbringing, more so after she's
We know something that even Lucy Higgs Nichols never knew. Her birth date.
Wow. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And how were you able to find, like, to talk a bit about, so were these all researchers from the Carnegie who dug this up, or did someone dig it up and then pitch it to y'all and you bought it, or how does it work?
Well, let me tell you the broader story first. Mrs. Pam Peters, who is our primary researcher for our Underground Railroad exhibit that we have at the Carnegie, she talked to one local person, Mrs. Pearl Kimbrough, and it was her family that preserved Lucy's story. And they were the only ones that had it. Mm-hmm. And so Pam Peters was intrigued by it, and eventually the real catalyst for where the story goes is this discovery of this photograph in the Indiana room at the local library, the only image we have of her. So that set Pam and her husband, Kurt, and another historian, Vic McGinnity, on a search across the country. They traveled to Bolivar. They traveled to all the different places, Coffeyville, Mississippi, Halifax County in North Carolina, where she was from. They're able to find in North Carolina, in the Higgs family papers, which still survives, a letter from the person who owned her, a Reuben Higgs. And in that letter, he describes her by name and her birth date, which we didn't know. I mean, she had other family as well, a brother and a sister. What happens to Lucy is that during her life, she's sent from farms in North Carolina, Mississippi, back to North Carolina, then to Tennessee. And her life gets kind of embroiled into the Higgs family as Reuben Higgs. He eventually has three wives, and there's all of this dispute among property. And so that's where a lot of the information that we have about her is because she got caught up in court cases. Right, where a lot of documents for primary source material came about.
I love it. Mm-hmm. So there's actually a marker in her honor that was erected in 2011. Mm-hmm. That's over on East Market Street in New Albany. As you mentioned, there is a permanent Underground Railroad exhibit as part of the Carnegie.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this, and this may be something that's outside of your purview, or maybe perhaps it's part of your approach to this work as well.
Okay.
You know, it's like, okay, that's cool. Underground Railroad, black people in your museum, that's cool. What led you all there? I mean, you know, they just caught me by surprise, for quite frankly. Southern Indiana, a whole exhibit about black people. Like, I was like, okay, what? But again, y'all did the black arts, you know, situation for us a few years ago. You have this. Do you all have a particular commitment to about diversity and race and progressive ideas? What kind of led you all to do these things?
Yeah, I think we do have that kind of progressive agenda. We're not a very large staff at all, but we're all very socially conscious and committed. And certainly how contemporary art plays into the picture these days, that's a very big part of what artists are doing, is making social comments. We're a very strange animal in a lot of ways, because the Carnegie Center, we are a department of the library. The Floyd, now it's called the Floyd County Library. It's been rebranded recently. So we're a lot of people think of us as more of a standalone kind of organization, but we're actually a part of the library and the library.
Of the library system of Southern Indiana.
That's
okay,
right.
That's cool.
Yeah, I'm a library employee.
Oh, okay.
So that
yeah.
kind of insulates me from some of the vagaries of, you know, all the fundraising required in other
not-for-profits.
Yeah. You
know?
So we have, you know, the support of a lot of folks. And, of course, our mission is to increase the culture and understanding of what's happening in Southern Indiana and make it that a benefit of those people. But we also interact with Louisville all the time, yeah. too. And we're connected
with the fairer side of the of, but never I'll, sure. I digress. Yeah. I apologize. Yeah.
But the Underground Railroad history. Yeah. I mean, there's not a large population of African Americans in Floyd County,
yeah. mm-hmm.
but there's a significant history with the Ohio River being the Mason-Dixon line, mm-hmm. and people trying to get over, you know, to seek freedom and get mm-hmm. on their way to Canada. All of the kind of things, all yeah. the complexities.
A lot of folks don't know that Kentucky, Louisville in particular. Cincinnati area, Indiana has a connection to the Underground Railroad. I mean,
right.
I think that a lot of Kentuckians especially
right.
think of enslavement, issues dealing with enslavement to be really, really deep south. And, mm-hmm. you know, Kentucky was neither a slave state nor a free. It is like, yeah, mm-hmm. that was some murky history
yeah.
going on, child.
I
you
mean,
know,
especially
like,
seen as the case of Margaret Garner is so ubiquitous with Morrison's Beloved. And she was enslaved in Kentucky and escaped across the Ohio
yeah.
and then was caught. And then there was a big trial. So I'm just not sure why people aren't aware of that, especially with Morrison
it happened
writing
more
a
than
whole
once.
Book. Yeah, I mean, yeah. right? So, I mean, there yeah. is a big, deep sense of it. I'm really, really fascinated with the story about Lucy. What mm-hmm. can visitors to you all's exhibit expect to see in addition to the facts mm-hmm. and information about Lucy? Is there also going to be things around the Civil War and Underground Railroad?
Her story really is in two parts.
Okay.
Her life prior to the Civil War and up to that point, and then what happens after she's in New Albany. Because there's one other event that happens that is unique and unparalleled in her life and is really one of the crowning points of her story. Late in life, the men being the surviving veterans being concerned about her old age and infirmity, when it became possible to apply for to petition the government, to petition Congress for a pension for services rendered during the war, the men got together and did a letter writing campaign petitioning Congress for on her behalf to try to get her awarded a pension.
Wow.
They were rejected twice, and eventually the men, 55 of them, came together, including many of the surviving surgeons from that time period, and they signed off on her testimony to her service to them and to the country.
Yeah.
And she is awarded a pension, $12 a month.
That's, yo, hey, listen.
I know, it doesn't sound like it.
I mean, I got food stamps one time. I was in college, I got food stamps one time. Those people gave me $8 a month. Look, this woman was born in 18-something. She got 12 bucks, y'all.
God.
But you know that doctor gave me, anyway, I digress.
$8
a month in food stamps. So I'm living like the 1800s.
Well, let me fix that a little bit there.
Goodness.
Because that $12 would translate to over like $350 today.
Wow.
And it was the same amount of money that a private in the union would have received.
Well, all right, all okay. right. Speaking of surgeons,
wow.
There's like different things on exhibit, including what I thought was really fascinating, an amputation saw that mm-hmm. was actually used by the surgeons that she existed.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
That's like so they really used the saw to cut people's limbs and such off?
Yeah. Yes, they did. You know, in trying to find new images of Lucy Higgs Nichols, because she was in 28 battles and you have these itinerant photographers around these campsites and hospital scenes, will we find other information, other images
yeah.
of her there? We do know that she did tell her life story to a prominent African-American newspaper at the time, but we have never found a copy of that.
Mm.
So there's still information to be
fruitcakes,
had.
Fruitcakes, there's your challenge.
There
somebody out there is a sleuth. Find us some that find us what we
okay.
need. Yeah.
Among the families that she knew were the Gresham family.
Okay.
And there was a General Gresham who was associated with the Indiana 23rd. Eventually, the Greshams even had family members that became Secretary of State in the country.
Wow.
But there was a family member that had a wedding at the Palmer House in Chicago, and Lucy was an invited special honor guest.
Wow.
I love this.
Was there any photographs taken at that wedding that we can find?
There were no photographs taken, or there were no photographs of her.
We haven't found it.
Okay,
you know, there may be the Gresham family.
Yeah, but not, she wouldn't have been. Yeah, certainly. Yeah.
Maybe she yeah. would have been. If
okay.
she was an honored guest and they brought her from New Albany to the Palmer House,
wow.
why would they not include her in a picture?
Hey, I'm with you there.
It's like, There's got to be more stuff.
That's something. Well, hopefully, I'll tell you what. This is a permanent exhibit. You have a couple permanent exhibits, including, as you mentioned briefly, an exhibit called Ordinary People, Extraordinary Courage, Men and Women of the Underground Railroad. This remembered the life of Lucy Higgs Nichols will also be the permanent collection. The Carnegie Center, what's the address over there?
The address is 201 East Spring Street in New Albany, Indiana.
That's right. And your website says once you visit, you'll never quite leave. Is there a cost to visit?
No, we're free.
It's free. All right.
And are you guys open all day long or what days?
We're open Tuesday through Saturdays from 10 to 5:30.
Yeah.
And if you have a cultural pass, we'll accept that. I don't know if you guys know about that program.
Yeah, the cultural pass for local people is like a summer-long kind of pass that allows you to visit several different sites throughout
45
And I think you perhaps get a prize or something at the very end.
Cool.
Or at least you get to pat yourself on the back because you did something cool. It's a really cool program. Hey, Al, thank you so much. This is really fascinating, and we appreciate you making the time to come in and share the story with our listeners. And please give us an update if you find more information, or perhaps another surgeon saw whatever you do as you update this exhibit over the years. Come back and tell us what other cool stuff you found. So thank you so much, and please take care.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for the invitation.
Yes.
Thanks, Al.
All right.
We are out of time. Say goodbye, Doc.
Bye.
Bye, everybody.
Strange Fruit is produced by Louisville Public Media. Our producer is Laura Ellis.
For more information, visit strangefruitpod.org, like us on Facebook, or follow us on Twitter at strangefruitpod.
The views expressed on Strange Fruit do not reflect those of LPM, its staff, or its underwriters.
Our executive producers are me, Jason Gardner.
And me, Kyla Story.
Thanks for listening.